Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Matt Fogelson, whose new book, Restrung: Fatherhood in a Different Key, is making its debut this week, I believe.
Correct, yes.
You have the reading scheduled where?
Out in the Bay Area this weekend. I'm out in Oakland at the moment, yeah.
When will you be back east?
Probably over the summer. So I reside out here, but my mom is still out on the East End over the summers. And so I try and get out there at least a couple times.
What does Restrung mean in the book? How does that play out?
Yeah. So the book is about coming to grips with the death of my father when I was in college and the realization that I didn't really know him. He was kind of a workaholic corporate attorney type, and the struggle to not pass down that emotional distance to my own son, which is an equation I hopefully solve for in part by sharing with him my passion for music, so he knows what makes his dad tick, something I didn't know about my own father. So music is kind of a through line of the book. From, you know, sort of passionate music lover as a kid, spending all my time and money shopping for records in Greenwich Village. I grew up in New York City. And then when my father died, as sort of an emotional outlet to help me deal with the grief of that when I was in college. And then finding connection with my son through sharing with him, as I say, my passion for music. So Restrung to me is kind of like recalibrating the father-son relationship in a way that's a little more connected than, hopefully, than what I had.
Came to new realizations. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. I think, you know, I kind of grew up on the Upper East Side. And, you know, my father was an attorney. Everyone in my parents' social circle was sort of a professional type. And I was very interested in music. I played guitar, but I never really thought of it as something that I could own myself. It was more of a diversion or a hobby. You know, it wasn't serious, like, you know, thing to do. I sort of came to realize after my dad died mostly that, you know, I ended up going to law school like him. And I think a large part of that was an effort to try and keep him close and sort of almost adopt. Yeah, I literally wore his suits to work. They never quite fit right, but maybe that's a metaphor. Sort of just came to realize that maybe I was on this path, not by my own, as a result of some constraint I put on myself. So I started a music blog about 10 years ago, which was fantastic and kind of led to this writing journey that I'm on.
What did you think you were going to do when you grew up, when you were a kid?
That's a good question. I don't know that I gave it a ton of thought. It's funny, in writing the book, I went back through all the archives, all the random documents of unknown provenance. One thing I came across was like a picture book. I was probably 5 years old, where the kid draws the pictures and the teacher writes in the caption dictated by the kid. And I had all these pictures of like my dad, my mom, my guinea pig. And then there was a picture of me, this sort of postmodern looking thing. I didn't have any limbs or anything. And it said, "I want to be a daddy when I grow up. This is me being a daddy." So, you know, for what that's worth, I don't know. Obviously, I don't remember drawing that, but I didn't have any strong, as a kid, predilections about what to do. And, you know, I kind of ended up just being funneled in a sense down the path. Literally everyone in my family was a lawyer. My grandfather, my uncle, my oldest cousin, my brother, my older brother went to law school. So, you know, I'm not going to absolve all, you know, all agency.
Why did you think that the changes that you were going through should be put into a book that others would read and comment on?
Yeah. Well, part of it is, I think, you know, obviously we all live our lives under external constraints, right? Health, financial. But I think sometimes we also place some internal constraints on ourselves without really even knowing it or thinking about it. And I think that's part of what I did. And so I think probably a lot of people do that. And that's part of it. I think it's also for folks that maybe lost a parent early, and fathers and sons who may be having trouble connecting, breaking through. I almost feel like that emotional distance is endemic in some ways to the father-son relationship. And so maybe helpful to folks trying to navigate those relationships.
You made some kind of breakthrough?
Well, I'd like to think so. I feel like I've come a long way from my relationship with my dad, which he just wasn't really around much. And I didn't really know who his friends were growing up. I didn't know what he was into. I didn't know what sports he played or really anything. And I think that led to sort of a distance, which I think after he died in some weird way, like it made me want to be connected to him more. And so I think that's where kind of the lawyer picked up steam. Maybe if I had felt more connected with him beforehand, I would have grieved differently. Not sure.
Have you worked on the book?
How long have I worked on the book?
How long was it being written?
Yeah. I worked on the book probably about 2 years to get to a draft that I was happy with. So, and it was, you know, 9 to 5 in a windowless basement office. This is like my nice new office with natural light, which I started writing the book here and it just didn't work. I needed to be in like a dark windowless place. So I had a room in the basement where I kind of squirreled away for 9 to 5. My guitars were down there. I could take breaks. Had an endless supply of Kleenex. It was perfect for that. I've since moved back to like the nicer office space.
Do you think that the better to go through this long period?
I think so. I mean, writing the book, I think I came to understand my dad a lot better. Kind of understood why he was driven the way he was. And I think I found some, I don't know, some forgiveness maybe and understanding, which has been helpful. You know, for a long time, I feel like I kind of walked around with this dark cloud hanging over me a little bit, just like this grief. You know, it's not like I was curled up in the fetal position on the couch or something. You know, I interacted with people, I have friends and stuff, but it was always like this overarching kind of sadness. And I think going through this process has helped alleviate some of that weight, I think, that I felt.
Tell me about the Hamptons and how you came out here and grew up and what you did here.
Yeah. So we had a place in West Hampton. And, you know, thinking back, like when I think of home, West Hampton in particular, sort of the home landscape, that's really where I would spend time with my dad. You know, we'd go fishing. We had a cruiser and then a little smaller Grady White. And we would go fishing for bluefish out Marichis. And it was just me and him. You know, my brother didn't have the stomach literally for boating. My mom was not outdoorsy. So this was just me and my dad. I have such fond memories of that. Not so much the waking up at 5:30 in the morning when it was pitch black out, but just having him alone without any work papers to distract him, cleaning the bluefish at the end of the dock when we got back. I remember just taking the boat to Nick's, I think it was called, kind of on the Shinnecock jetty there where we'd get steamers. I learned to drive. My dad bought me a car at Otis Ford, a stick shift, even though I didn't know how to drive stick shift. I learned on Dune Road. You don't tell the authorities, but, you know, sort of put it together out there. So that's really the place where I think of my dad. I think of West Hampton in particular, sort of the end of our dock and just the stillness of it. And, you know, like there was a period in law school when I was at NYU, and there was a lot of grief and self-loathing going on, a lot of cacophony in my head. Music helped with some of that, but sometimes I just needed some stillness. And I'd take the train out to West Hampton and I'd go stand at the end of the dock and just listen, could hear the waves across on Dune Road crashing onto the beach. And then there'd be a silence right before the next wave. And I would just stand out there and just listen for that stillness. And, you know, we got married at our house in West Hampton. My son met his great grandmother there, and he has since become quite connected to it. I remember when he was, I don't know, maybe 10 years old, we went to Briarmere Farms, which is, of course, our ritual every time we're out there, get about 4 pies in Riverhead. And he said, "You don't know happiness till you've had a Briarmere pie," which, you know, maybe there's some truth to that.
How did music help in all of this?
I think music, first of all, it was sort of an outlet for a lot of the anger and rage that I had. My dad died in 1991, which was right when grunge was taken off. So, you know, all those Seattle bands, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden. Soundgarden in particular, their Super Unknown record, which was kind of a dark album. And the lead singer, Chris Cornell, there was a lot of like screaming. And I didn't know how to kind of off-gas this toxicity that I felt. And so basically Chris Cornell screamed for me. And also felt like there was so much self-loathing in that record, which I was in a bad cycle of at that time. And I felt like somebody understood that and had my back, even if their intentions were pure malevolence. It was like, okay. And I would have these listening sessions where I would just like put the headphones on, play this music super loud, and it would be restorative. You know, I felt like I could engage with people after that.
I remember somebody that I knew who had this kind of anger going to therapy where he would hit pillows with a tennis racket.
Yeah.
Felt it all had left him.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was in law school. I had a roommate. I felt like, you know, screaming. I mean, but thinking back on it, if you're going to go out in public and scream, New York City is probably not a bad place to do it. People might not even look at you. Funny. But yeah, it created this space where I could just sort of be myself. I didn't have to say I'm okay when people asked how I was doing. You know, I could feel the grief and the sadness and just kind of be my truest self in those moments.
Do you have a big family or just you and your brother?
Just me and my brother. Yeah.
You grew up as a New Yorker and the Hamptons is part of that. And what brought you west?
So my girlfriend at the time, now wife, was also a lawyer. And she was way more cerebral than me, kind of an academic type. She wanted to go back and get a PhD in sociology. And so she ended up at Cal in Berkeley. And so, you know, I think like a lot of people, our intention was to move out here for a discrete period of time while she knocked that out. In the meantime, we had our son out here and then just kind of came to view it as home. When we moved out here, I think I came on one business trip with my dad to San Francisco. I was probably not even in high school, in middle school. I remember it quite vividly. He got up in front of this huge crowd at this hotel ballroom or whatever. And he said, so he was a mergers and acquisitions attorney. He started his speech by saying, I'm here today to talk about Raiders, but not the Oakland Raiders. And I was remember being like, ugh. But the crowd ate it up, you know, I guess he knew his audience. But I hadn't ever really set foot in California before we moved out here. It's kind of funny.
By the comparison, has it become less attractive in recent years, particularly because of the fires and things like that?
Yes, that's certainly an issue. I mean, my son's now at UCLA, where they were basically evacuated last year for the fires. And it's a constant concern. Every time it happens, we kind of look at each other and are like, I mean, if it's not a fire, it's an earthquake, mudslides. I mean, we don't have tornadoes. We don't have the ice storms. Every time I'm on the Bay Bridge, I kind of wonder, I hope the big one doesn't hit in the next 2 minutes. But, you know, it took a lot of adjustments moving from New York out here. As you would expect, it was a big culture clash. I remember driving, pedestrians would just walk out into the crosswalk, like as if you were going to stop. And, you know, you're supposed to stop, I guess, but it took me a while to kind of get used to that. That wasn't my experience on the East Coast, you know, like cab drivers, you know, like if you didn't scatter when they came through that intersection, that's on you. And I went to college in North Carolina, which was even more of a culture shock, the slow pace there. I remember people asking me, were you in one of those skyscrapers? I was like, you mean an apartment building? Where did you go play? How did you play? It's like, you know, we played running bases on the street. Yeah, no, yeah, there were some scuffed up knees. You ever get mugged? Yeah. Several times, people were sort of incredulous, but it seemed normal to me.
Well, it's a good ways around part of the earth. You know, there's nothing like the beaches in the Hamptons in the West Coast, which is kind of a surprise.
And also just, you can't really swim in the ocean here because the riptides are so fierce. And also there's no, like on the East Coast, it's kind of the gradual shelf, right? Out here, it's like, it gets so deep so fast. And I think that creates these huge waves. Maybe, I don't know, I'm not an oceanographer, but yeah, it's a totally different kind of experience going to the beach here. I mean, first of all, up here, you can't wear a t-shirt and shorts. You know, you're wearing layers because it's windy and 58 degrees, even in the summer. But yeah, the beaches of Long Island, you know, in the Hamptons, my mom has said that forever, like exactly that. There's nothing like that. And I've come to appreciate that. It's one of my favorite things is coming back, going out there and just walking on the beach, listening to the ocean. A lot of things have changed in the Hamptons. I remember this great op-ed piece by John Cole, the author, in the Times in the late 90s. I guess he moved to Maine, but he grew up like in the 20s and 30s in out in, I think maybe in Bridgehampton or Sagaponack, maybe. Anyway, he wrote this amazing op-ed when he was much older, and he was reminiscing about his time in the Hamptons because this was going to be his last visit, he assumed, to the Hamptons, and just talking about how it's obviously changed so much since the 20s and 30s when he was there, but it's some of it is timeless, right? The ocean, the beach, the Bayman, you know, bull raking clams. And there's so much to that, you know, there's so much truth to that too. I feel the exact same way. Like it's, there's so much timelessness about the place, even over all this change.
When are you coming back?
Hopefully in June, if not sooner. Definitely in June, hopefully sooner.
Are you going to be writing another book, or do you think that's it?
Possibly. I have a couple ideas, mostly around characters in Restrung, who I think would benefit from a longer treatment. Some stuff got left on the cutting room floor. I think about my Aunt Wendy in particular, my mom's younger sister, who is very important person to me. She was sort of the counterexample to my parents. You know, she was a flower child type, lived in upstate, in Carmel, New York, a little bit upstate. And she would always wear these flower sundresses and so many bracelets. You could hear her coming a mile away. And she loved Bob Dylan. Like she was a proselytizer for Bob Dylan and gave me all his old records. And she really helped me kind of get in touch with my passion. I don't think I really appreciated that till later in life, how much of an influence she had on me, because she wasn't around much. Maybe twice a year we'd see her. But anyway, I think she had a pretty interesting life. And so I think there's some more to be said about her. So, but we'll see. Right now I'm focused on, you know, the book launch, and I've got a couple short form narrative pieces that I'm working on, which is sort of how I got started in writing. So we'll see.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast. It's good to see you. And when you get out here, I hope we get to see one another.
Yeah, that would be great. Appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on. This has been fun.
Have a good day.
All right. Thank you.